Books on Tape presents Empire of Ivory by Naomi Novik, read by Simon Vance. Part 1. Chapter 1.
Send up another, damn you! Send them all up! At once, if you have to!
Lawrence said savagely to poor Calloway, who did not deserve to be sworn at. The gunner was firing off the flares so quickly his hands were scorched black, skin cracking and peeling to bright red where some powder had spilled onto his fingers. He was not stopping to wipe them clean before setting each flare to the match. One of the little French dragons darted in again, slashing at Temeraire's side, and five men fell screaming as a piece of the makeshift carrying harness unravelled. They vanished at once beyond the lantern light and were swallowed up in the dark. The long, twisted rope of striped silk, a pillaged curtain, unfurled gently in the wind and went billowing down after them, threads trailing from the torn edges. A moan went through the other Prussian soldiers still clinging desperately to the harness, and after it followed a low, angry muttering in German. Any gratitude the soldiers might have felt for their rescue from the siege of Danzig had since been exhausted. 3 days flying through icy rain, no food but what they had crammed into their pockets in those final desperate moments, no rest but a few hours snatched along a cold and marshy stretch of the Dutch coast, and now this French patrol harrying them all this last endless night. Men so terrified might do anything in a panic. Many of them had still their small arms and swords, and there were more than 100 of them crammed aboard, to the less than 30 of Temeraire's own crew. Lawrence swept the sky again with his glass, straining for a glimpse of wings, an answering signal. They were in sight of shore. The night was clear. Through his glass he saw the gleam of lights dotting the small harbours all along the Scottish coast, and below heard the steadily increasing roar of the surf. Their flares ought to have been plain to see all the way to Edinburgh. Yet no reinforcements had come. Not a single courier beast even to investigate.
"Sir, that's the last of them,"
Calloway said, coughing through the grey smoke that wreathed his head, the flare whistling high and away. The powder flash went off silently above their heads, casting the white, scudding clouds into brilliant relief, reflecting from dragon scales in every direction. Temeraire all in black, the rest in gaudy colours muddied to shades of grey by the lurid blue light. The night was full of their wings, a dozen dragons turning their heads around to look back, their gleaming pupils narrowing. More coming on, all of them laden down with men, and a handful of small French patrol dragons darting among them. All seen in the flash of a moment. Then the thunderclap, crack and rumble sounded only a little delayed, and the flare dying away drifted into blackness again. Lawrence counted 10. And 10 again. Still there was no answer from the shore. Emboldened, the French dragon came in once more. Temeraire aimed a swipe which would have knocked the little Poux de Ciel flat, but his attempt was very slow, for fear of dislodging any more of his passengers. Their small enemy evaded with contemptuous ease and circled away to wait for his next chance.
"Lawrence," Temeraire said, looking round, "where are they all? Victoriatus is in Edinburgh. He at least ought to have come. After all, we helped him when he was hurt. Not that I need help, precisely, against these little dragons," he added, straightening his neck with a crackle of popping joints. "But it is not very convenient to try and fight while we are carrying so many people."
This was putting a braver face on the situation than it deserved. They could not very well defend themselves at all, and Temeraire was taking the worst of it, bleeding already from many small gashes along his side and flanks, which the crew could not bandage up, so cramped were they aboard.
"Only keep everyone moving towards the shore,"
Lawrence said. He had no better answer to give.
"I cannot imagine the patrol will pursue us over land,"
he added, but doubtfully. He would never have imagined a French patrol could come so near to shore as this, either, without challenge, and how he should manage to disembark 1,000 frightened and exhausted men under bombardment he did not like to contemplate.
"I am trying, only they will keep stopping to fight,"
Temeraire said wearily, and turned back to his work. Arcady and his rough band of mountain ferals found the small stinging attacks maddening, and they kept trying to turn around mid-air and go after the French patrol dragons, In their contortions they were flinging off more of the hapless Prussian soldiers than the enemy could ever have accounted for. There was no malice in their carelessness. The wild dragons were unused to men except as the jealous guardians of flocks and herds, and they did not think of their passengers as anything more than an unusual burden. But with malice or none, the men were dying all the same. Temeraire could only prevent them by constant vigilance, and now he was hovering in place over the line of flight, cajoling and hissing by turns, encouraging the others to hurry onwards.
"No, no, Gerny!" Temeraire called out, and dashed forward to swat at the little blue-and-white feral.
She had dropped onto the very back of a startled French chasseur vocifère, a courier beast of scarcely 4 tons, who could not bear up under even her slight weight, and was sinking in the air despite the frantic beating of its wings. Gerny had already fixed her teeth in the French dragon's neck, and was now worrying it back and forth with savage vigour. Meanwhile the Prussians, clinging to her harness, were all but drumming their heels on the heads of the French crew, crammed so tightly not a shot from the French side could fail of killing one of them. In his efforts to dislodge her, Temeraire was left open, and the Poudre de Ciel seized the fresh opportunity, this time daring enough to make an attempt at Temeraire's back. His claws struck so near that Lawrence saw the traces of Temeraire's blood shining black on the curved edges as the French dragon lifted away again. His hand tightened on his pistol, uselessly.
"Oh, let me, let me!"
Iskiaka was straining furiously against the restraints which kept her lashed down to Temeraire's back. The infant Kazilik would soon enough be a force to reckon with. As yet, however, scarcely a month out of the shell, she was too young and unpracticed to be a serious danger to anyone besides herself. They had tried as best they could to secure her with straps and chains and lecturing, but the last she roundly ignored, and though she had been but irregularly fed these last few days, she had added another 5 feet of length overnight. Neither straps nor chains were proving of much use in restraining her.
"Will you hold still for all love?"
Granby said despairingly. He was throwing his own weight against the straps to try and pull her head down. Alan and Harley, the young lookouts stationed on Temeraire's shoulders, had to go scrambling out of the way to avoid being kicked as Granby was dragged stumbling from side to side by her efforts. Lawrence loosened his buckles and climbed to his feet, bracing his heels against the strong ridge of muscle at the base of Temeraire's neck. He caught Granby by the harness belt when Iskierka's thrashing swung him by again, and managed to hold him steady. But all the leather was strung tight as violin strings, trembling with the strain.
"But I can stop him,"
she insisted, twisting her head sidelong as she tried to work free. Eager jets of flame were licking out of the sides of her jaws as she tried once again to lunge at the enemy dragon, but their Poudre de Ciel attacker, small as he was still many times her size, and too experienced to be frightened off by a little show of fire. He only jeered, back winging to expose all of his speckled brown belly to her as a target in a gesture of insulting unconcern.
"Oh!"
Iskierka coiled herself tightly with rage, the thin, spiky protrusions all over her sinuous body jetting steam, and then with a mighty heave she reared herself up on her hindquarters. The straps jerked painfully out of Lawrence's grasp, and involuntarily he caught his hand back to his chest, the numb fingers curling over in reaction. Granby had been dragged into mid-air, and was dangling from her thick neck-band vainly while she let loose a torrent of flame, thin and yellow-white, so hot the air about it seemed to twist and shrivel away, it made a fierce banner against the night sky. But the French dragon had cleverly put himself before the wind, coming strong and from the east. Now he folded his wings and dropped away, and the blistering flames were blown back against Temeraire's flank. Temeraire, still scolding Gerny back into the line of flight, uttered a startled cry and jerked away while sparks scattered over the glossy blackness of his hide, perilously close to the carrying harness of silk and linen and rope.
"Verfluchte Sontier! Wir werden noch alle verbrennen!"
One of the Prussian officers yelled hoarsely, pointing at Iskierka, and fumbled with shaking hand in his bandolier for a cartridge.
"Enough there! Put up that pistol!"
Lawrence roared at him through the speaking trumpet. Lieutenant Ferris and a couple of the top men hurriedly unlatched their harness straps and let themselves down to wrestle it out of the officer's hands. They could only reach the fellow by clambering over the other Prussian soldiers, however, and while too afraid to let go of the harness, the men were obstructing their passage in every other way, thrusting out elbows and hips with abrupt jerks, full of resentment and hostility. Lieutenant Riggs was giving orders, distantly, towards the rear.
"Fire!"
he shouted, clear over the increasing rumble among the Prussians. The handful of rifles spoke with bright powder bursts, sulphurous and bitter. The French dragon made a little shriek and wheeled away, flying a little awkward. Blood streaked in rivulets from a rent in his wing, where a bullet had by lucky chance struck one of the thinner patches around the joint and penetrated the tough, resilient hide. The respite came late. Some of the men were already clawing their way up towards Temeraire's back, snatching at the greater security of the leather harness to which the aviators were hooked by their carabiner straps. But the harness could not take all their weight, not so many of them. If the buckles stretched open, or some straps gave way and the hole began to slide, it would entangle Temeraire's wings and send them all plummeting into the ocean together. Lawrence loaded his pistols fresh and thrust them into his waistband, loosened his sword and stood up again. He had willingly risked all their lives to bring these men out of a trap, and he meant to see them safely ashore if he could, but he would not see Temeraire endangered by their hysteric fear.
"Alan, Harley," he said to the boys, "do you run across the riflemen and tell Mr. Riggs, if we cannot stop them, they are to cut the carrying harness loose, all of it, and be sure you keep latched on as you go. Perhaps you had better stay here with her, John," he added, when Granby made to come away with him.
Iskierka had quieted for the moment, her enemy having quitted the field, but she still coiled and recoiled herself in sulky restlessness, muttering in disappointment.
"Oh, certainly. I should like to see myself do any such thing," Granby said, taking out his sword.
He had forgone pistols since becoming Iskierka's captain, to avoid the risk of handling open powder around her. Lawrence was too unsure of his ground to pursue an argument. Granby was not properly his subordinate any longer, and the more experienced aviator of the two of them, counting years aloft. Granby took the lead as they crossed Temeraire's back, moving with the sureness of a boy trained up from the age of 7. At each step, Lawrence handed forward his own lead strap and let Granby lock it onto the harness for him, which he could do one-handed, that they might go more quickly. Peris and the topmen were still struggling with the Prussian officer in the midst of a thickening clot of men. They were disappearing from view under the violent press of bodies, only Martin's yellow hair visible. The soldiers were near full riot, men beating and kicking at one another, thinking of nothing but an impossible escape. The knots of the carrying harness were tightening, giving up more slack, so all the loops and bands of it hung loose and swinging with the thrashing, struggling men. Lawrence came on one of the soldiers, a young man, eyes wide and staring in his wind-reddened face, and his thick moustache, wet-tipped with sweat, trying to work his arm beneath the main harness, blindly, though the buckle was already straining open, and he would, in a moment, have slid wholly free.
"Get back to your place!"
Lawrence shouted, pointing to the nearest open loop of the carrying harness, and thrust the man's hand away from the harness. Then his ears were ringing, a thick, ripe smell of sour cherries in his nostrils as his knees folded beneath him. He put a hand to his forehead, slowly, stupidly. It was wet. His own harness straps were holding him, painfully tight against his ribs, with all his weight pulling against them. The Prussian had struck him with a bottle. It had shattered, and the liquor was dripping down the side of his face. Instinct rescued him. He put up his arm to take the next blow and pushed the broken glass back at the man's face. The soldier said something in German and let go the bottle. They wrestled together a few moments more, then Lawrence caught the man's belt and heaved him up and away from Temeraire's side. The soldier's arms were spread wide, grasping at nothing. Lawrence, watching, abruptly recalled himself, and at once he lunged out, reaching to his full length, but too late, and he came thumping heavily back against Temeraire's side with empty hands. The soldier was already gone from sight. His head did not hurt overmuch, but Lawrence felt queerly sick and weak. Temeraire had resumed flying towards the coast, having rounded up the rest of the Farrells at last, and the force of the wind was increasing. Lawrence clung to the harness a moment until the fit passed, and he was able to make his hands work properly again. There were already more men clawing up. Granby was trying to hold them back, but they were overbearing him by sheer weight of numbers, even though struggling as much against one another as him. One of the soldiers, grappling for a hold on the harness, climbed too far out of the press. He slipped, landed heavily on the men below him, and carried them all away. As a tangled, many-limbed mass, they fell into the slack loops of the carrying harness, and the muffled, wet noises of their bones cracking together sounded like a roast chicken being wrenched hungrily apart. Granby was hanging from his harness straps, trying to get his feet planted again. Lawrence Crabb walked over to him and gave him a steadying arm. Below he could just make out the washy sea-foam pale against the black water. Temeraire was flying lower and lower as they neared the coast.
"That damned Poudre de Ciel is coming round again!"
Granby panted as he got back his footing. The French had somehow got a dressing over the gash in the dragon's wing, even if the great white patch of it was awkwardly placed and far larger than the injury made necessary. The dragon looked a little uncomfortable in the air, but he was coming on gamely nonetheless. They had surely seen that Temeraire was vulnerable. If the Poudre de Ciel and his crew were able to catch the harness and drag it loose, they might finish deliberately what the soldiers had begun in panic, and the chance of bringing down a heavyweight, much less one as valuable as Temeraire, would surely tempt them to great risk.
"We will have to cut the soldiers loose," Lawrence said, low and wretched, and looked upwards where the carrying loops attached to the leather.
But to send 100 men and more to their deaths, scarce minutes from safety, he was not sure he could bear, or ever to meet General Calcroyte again, having done it. Some of the General's own young aides were aboard, and doing their best to keep the other men quiet. Riggs and his riflemen were firing short, hurried volleys. The Poudre de Ciel was keeping just out of range, waiting for the best moment to chance his attack. Then Iskiaka sat up and blew out another stream of fire. Temeraire was flying ahead of the wind, so the flames were not turned against him this time. But every man on his back had at once to throw himself flat to avoid the torrent, which burnt out too quickly before it could reach the French dragon. The Poudre de Ciel at once darted in, while the crew were so distracted. Iskiaka was gathering herself for another blow, and the riflemen could not get up again.
"Christ!"
Granby said, but before he could reach her a low rumble like fresh thunder sounded, and below them small, round, red mouths bloomed with smoke and powder flashes. Shore batteries, firing from the coast below. Illuminated in the yellow blaze of Iskiaka's fire, a 24-pound ball of round shot flew past them and took the Poudre de Ciel full in the chest. He folded around it like paper as it drove through his ribs, and crumpled out of the air, falling to the rocks below. They were over the shore, they were over the land, and thick, fleeced sheep were fleeing before them across the snow-matted grass. The townspeople of the little harbour of Dunbar were alternately terrified at the descent of a whole company of dragons onto their quiet hamlet, and elated by the success of their new shore battery, put into place scarcely 2 months ago and never before tried. Half a dozen courier beasts driven off, and one Poudre de Ciel slain, overnight became a Grand Chevalier and several Flammes de Gloire, all hideously killed. The town could talk of nothing else, and the local militia strutted through the streets to general satisfaction. The townspeople grew less enthusiastic, however, after Arcady had eaten 4 of their sheep. The other ferals had made only slightly less extravagant depredations, and Temeraire himself had seized upon a couple of cows, shaggy, yellow-haired Highland cattle, sadly reported afterwards to be prize-winning, and devoured them to the hooves and horns.
"They were very tasty," Temeraire said apologetically,
and turned his head aside to spit out some of the hair. Lawrence was not inclined to stint the dragons in the least after their long and arduous flight, and on this occasion was perfectly willing to sacrifice his ordinary respect for property to their comfort. Some of the farmers made noises about payment, but Lawrence did not mean to try and feed the bottomless appetites of the ferals out of his own pocket. The Admiralty might reach into theirs, if they had nothing better to do than sit before the fire and whistle while a battle was carrying on outside their windows, and men dying for lack of a little assistance.
"We will not be a charge upon you for long. As soon as we hear from Edinburgh, I expect we will be called to the covert there," he said flatly, in reply to the protests. The horse courier left at once.
The townspeople were more welcoming to the Prussians, most of them young soldiers, pale and wretched after the flight. General Calcroyte himself had been among these final refugees. He had to be let down from Arkady's back in a sling, his face white and sickly under his beard. The local medical man looked doubtful, but cupped a basin full of blood and had him carried away to the nearest farmhouse, to be kept warm and dosed with brandy and hot water. Other men were less fortunate. The harnesses, cut away, came down in filthy and tangled heaps, weighted by corpses already turning greenish, some killed by the French attacks, others smothered by their own fellows in the panic, or dead of thirst, or plain terror. They buried 63 men out of 1,000 that afternoon, some of them nameless, in a long and shallow grave laboriously pickaxed out of the frozen ground. The survivors were a ragged crew, clothes and uniforms inadequately brushed, faces still dirty, attending silently. Even the ferals, though they did not understand the language, perceived the ceremony and sat on their haunches respectfully to watch from a distance. Word came back from Edinburgh only a few hours later, but with orders so queer as to be incomprehensible. They began, reasonably enough, the Prussians to be left behind in Dunbar and quartered in the town, and the dragons, as expected, summoned to the city. But there was no invitation to General Kalkreuth or his officers to come along. To the contrary, Lawrence was strictly adjured to bring no Prussian officers with him. As for the dragons, they were not permitted to come into the large and comfortable covert itself at all, not even Temeraire. Instead, Lawrence was ordered to leave them sleeping in the streets about the castle, and to report to the admiral in command in the morning. He stifled his first reaction and spoke mildly of the arrangements to Major Siebeling, now the senior Prussian, implying, as best he could without any outright falsehood, that the admiralty meant to wait until General Kalkreuth was recovered for an official welcome.
"Oh, must we fly again?" Temeraire said.
He heaved himself wearily back onto his feet and went around the drowsing ferals to nudge them awake. They had all crumpled into somnolence after their dinners. Their flight was slow, and the days were grown short. It lacked only a week to Christmas, Lawrence realized abruptly. The sky was fully dark by the time they reached Edinburgh, but the castle shone out for them like a beacon, with its windows and walls bright with torches, on its high rocky hill above the shadowed expanse of the covert, with the narrow buildings of the old medieval part of the city crammed together close around it. Temeraire hovered doubtfully above the cramped and winding streets. There were many spires and pointed roofs to contend with, and not very much room between them, giving the city the appearance of a spear-pit.
"I do not see how I am to land," he said uncertainly. "I am sure to break one of those buildings. Why have they built these streets so small? It was much more convenient in Peking."
"If you cannot do it without hurting yourself, we will go away again and orders be damned," Lawrence said.
His patience was grown very thin. But in the end Temeraire managed to let himself down into the old cathedral square without bringing down more than a few lumps of ornamental masonry. The ferals, being all of them considerably smaller, had less difficulty. They were anxious at being removed from the fields full of sheep and cattle, however, and suspicious of their new surroundings. Arkady bent low and put his eye to an open window to peer inside at the empty rooms, making sceptical inquiries of Temeraire as he did so.
"That is where people sleep, is it not, Lawrence? Like a pavilion," Temeraire said,
trying cautiously to rearrange his tail into a more comfortable position.
"And sometimes where they sell jewels and other pleasant things. But where are all the people?"
Lawrence was quite sure all the people had fled. The wealthiest tradesman in the city would be sleeping in a gutter tonight, if it were the only bed he could find in the new part of town, safely far away from the pack of dragons who had invaded his streets. The dragons eventually disposed of themselves in some reasonable comfort. The ferals, used to sleeping in rough-hewn caves, were even pleased with the soft and rounded cobblestones.
"I do not mind sleeping in the street, Lawrence, truly. It is quite dry, and I am sure it will be very interesting to look at in the morning," Temeraire said consolingly,
even with his head lodged in one alleyway and his tail in another. But Lawrence minded for him. It was not the sort of welcome which he felt they might justly have looked for, a long year away from home, having been sent halfway round the world and back. It was one thing to find themselves in rough quarters while on campaign, where no man could expect better, and might be glad for a cowbar to lay his head in, to be deposited like baggage on the cold, unhealthy stones, stained years dark with street refuse, was something other. The dragons might at least have been granted use of the open farmland outside the city. And it was no conscious malice, only the common, unthinking assumption by which men treated dragons as inconvenient, if elevated, livestock, to be managed and herded without consideration for their own sentiments. An assumption so ingrained that Lawrence had recognized it as outrageous only when forced to do so by the marked contrast with the conditions he had observed in China, where dragons were received as full members of society. "Well," Temeraire said reasonably, while Lawrence laid out his own bedroll inside the house beside his head, with the windows open so they might continue to speak.
"We knew how matters were here, Lawrence, so we cannot be very surprised. Besides, I did not come to make myself more comfortable, or I might have stayed in China. We must improve the circumstances of all our friends. Not," he added, "that I would not like my own pavilion, but I would rather have liberty. Dyer, will you pray get that bit of gristle out from between my teeth? I cannot reach forward to put my claw upon it."
Dyer startled up from his half-doze upon Temeraire's back, and, fetching a small pick from their baggage, scrambled obediently into Temeraire's opened jaws to scrape away.
"You would have more luck in achieving the latter if there were more men ready to grant you the former," Lawrence said. "I do not mean to counsel you to despair. We must not, indeed. But I had hoped to find on our arrival more respect than when we left, not less, which must have been a material advantage to our cause."
Temeraire waited until Dyer had climbed out again to answer.
"I am sure we must be listened to on the merits," he said,
a large assumption which Lawrence was not at all sanguine enough to share.
"And all the more when I have seen Maximus and Lily, and they are ranged with me. And perhaps also Exidium, for he has been in so many battles. No one could help but be impressed with him. I am sure they will see all the wisdom of my arguments. They will not be so stupid as Heroic and the others were,"
Temeraire added, with shades of resentment. The Prussian dragons had at first rather disdained his attempts at convincing them of the merits of greater liberty and education, being as fond of their tradition of rigorous military order as ever were their handlers, and preferring instead to ridicule as effete the habits of thought which Temeraire had acquired in China.
"I hope you will forgive me for bluntness, but I'm afraid even if you had the hearts and minds of every dragon in Britain aligned with your own, it would make very little difference. As a party, you have not very much influence in Parliament," Lawrence said.
"Perhaps we do not, but I imagine if we were to go to Parliament, we would be attended to," Temeraire said.
An image most convincing, if not likely to produce the sort of attention which Temeraire desired. Lawrence said as much, and added,
"We must find some better means of drawing sympathy to your cause, from those who have the influence to foster political change. I am only sorry I cannot apply to my father for advice, as relations stand between us."
"Well, I am not sorry at all," Temeraire said, putting back his ruff. "I am sure he would not have helped us, and we can do perfectly well without him."
Aside from his loyalty, which would have resented coldness to Lawrence on any grounds, he not unnaturally viewed Lord Allendale's objections to the aerial corps as objections to his own person, and despite their never having met, he felt violently as a matter of course towards anyone whose sentiments would have seen Lawrence separated from him.
"My father has been engaged with politics half his life," Lawrence said,
with the effort towards abolition in particular, a movement met with as much scorn at its inception as Lawrence anticipated for Temeraire's own.
"I assure you his advice would be of the greatest value, and I do mean to effect a repair, if I can, which would allow our consulting him."
"I would as soon have kept it myself," Temeraire muttered,
meaning the elegant red vase which Lawrence had purchased in China as a conciliatory gift. It had since travelled with them 5,000 miles and more, and Temeraire had grown inclined to be as possessive of it as any of his own treasures. He now sighed to see it finally sent away, with Lawrence's brief and apologetic note. But Lawrence was all too conscious of the difficulties which faced them, and of his own inadequacy to forward so vast and complicated a cause. He had been still a boy when Wilberforce had come to their house, the guest of one of his father's political friends, newly inspired with fervour against the slave trade and beginning the parliamentary campaign to abolish it. 20 years ago now, and despite the most heroic efforts by men of ability and wealth and power greater than his own, in those 20 years, surely 1 million souls or more had yet been carried away from their native shores into bondage. Temeraire had been hatched in the year 5. For all his intelligence, he could not yet truly grasp the weary, slow struggle which should be required to bring men to a political position, however moral and just, however necessary, in any way contrary to their immediate self-interest. Lawrence bade him good night without further disheartening advice, but as he closed the windows, which began to rattle gently from the sleeping dragon's breath, the distance to the covert beyond the castle walls seemed to him less easily bridged than all the long miles which had brought them home from China. The Edinburgh streets were quiet in the morning, unnaturally so, and deserted but for the dragons sleeping in stretched ranks over the old grey cobbles. Temeraire's great bulk was heaped awkwardly before the smoke-stained cathedral, and his tail running down into an alleyway scarcely wide enough to hold it. The sky was clear and cold and very blue, only a handful of terraced clouds running out to sea, a faint suggestion of pink and orange early light on the stones. Farquhar was awake, the only soul stirring when Lawrence came out. He was sitting, crouched against the cold, in one of the other narrow doorways to an elegant home, the heavy door standing open behind him, looking into the entry hall, tapestried and deserted. He had a cup of tea steaming in the air. "May I offer you one?" he inquired. "I am sure the owners would not begrudge it."
"No, I must go up," Lawrence said.
He had been woken by a runner from the castle, summoning him to a meeting at once. Another piece of discourtesy, when they had only arrived so late. And to make matters worse, the boy had been unable to tell him of any provisions made for the feeding of the hungry dragons. What the ferals should say when they awoke, Lawrence did not like to think.
"You need not worry. I am sure they will fend for themselves," Farquhar said,
not a cheering prospect, and offered Lawrence his own cup for consolation. Lawrence sighed and drained it, grateful for the strong, hot brew. He gave Farquhar back the cup and hesitated. The other man was looking across the cathedral square with a peculiar expression, his mouth twisted at one corner.
"Are you well?"
Lawrence asked, conscious he had thought not enough about his men in his anxiety over Temeraire, and Tharkay he had had less right to take for granted.
"Oh, very. I am quite at home," Tharkay said. "It is some time since I was last in Britain, but I was tolerably familiar with the Court of Session then,"
nodding across the square at Parliament House, where the court met. Scotland's highest civil court, and a notorious pit of broken hopes, endless dragging suits and wrangling over technicalities and estates, presently deserted by all its solicitors, judges, and suitors alike, and only a scattering of harried papers blown up against Temeraire's side like white patches, relics of old settlements. Tharkay's father had been a man of property, Lawrence knew. Tharkay had none. The son of a Nepalese woman, perhaps, would have been at some disadvantage in the British courts, Lawrence supposed, and any irregularity in his claims easily exploited. At least he did not look at all enthusiastic to be home, if home he considered it. And Lawrence said,
"I hope,"
tentatively, and tried awkwardly to suggest that Tharkay might consider extending his contract when they had settled such delicate matters as payment for those services already rendered. Tharkay had been paid for guiding them along the old silk trading routes from China, but since then he had recruited the ferals to their cause, which demanded a bounty beyond Lawrence's private means. And his services could by no means be easily dispensed with now, not until the ferals were settled somehow into the corps, Tharkay being, apart from Temeraire, almost the only one who could manage more than a few words of their odd, inflected language.
"I would gladly speak to Admiral Lenton at Dover, if you would not object," Lawrence added.
He did not at all mean to discuss any such irregular question with whichever notable was commanding here, after the treatment which they had so far received. Thage only shrugged, non-committal, and said, "Your messenger grows anxious," nodding to where the young runner was fidgeting unhappily at the corner of the square, waiting for Lawrence to come along. The boy took him the short distance up the hill to the castle gates. From there Lawrence was escorted to the Admiral's office by an officious, red-coated marine, their path winding around to the headquarters building through the medieval stone courtyards, empty and free from hurry in the early morning dimness. The doors were opened, and he went in stiffly, straight-shouldered. His face had set into disapproving lines, cold and rigid.
"Sir,"
he said, eyes fixed at a point upon the wall, and only then glanced down, and said, surprised,
"Admiral Lenton?" "Lawrence, yes, sit down."
Lenton dismissed the guard, and the door closed upon them and the musty, book-lined room. The Admiral's desk was nearly clear, but for a single, small map, a handful of papers. Lenton sat for a moment, silently.
"It is damned good to see you,"
he said at last.
"Very good to see you indeed, very good."
Lawrence was very much shocked at his appearance. In the year since their last meeting, Lenton seemed to have aged 10. Hair gone entirely white, and a vague, rheumy look in his eyes, his jowls hung slack.
"I hope I find you well, sir,"
Lawrence said, deeply sorry, no longer wondering why Lenton had been transferred north to Edinburgh, the quieter post. He wondered only what illness might have so ravaged him, and who had been made commander at Dover in his place.
"Oh,"
Lenton waved his hand, fell silent.
"I suppose you have not been told anything,"
he said after a moment.
"No, that is right. We agreed we could not risk word getting out."
"No, sir," Lawrence said, anger kindling afresh. "I have heard nothing, and been told nothing, with our allies asking me daily for word of the corps, until there was no more use in asking." He had given his own personal assurances to the Prussian commanders. He had sworn that the aerial corps would not fail them, that the promised company of dragons, which might have turned the tide against Napoleon in this last disastrous campaign, would arrive at any moment. He and Temeraire had stayed and fought in their place when the dragons did not arrive, risking their own lives and those of his crew in an increasingly hopeless cause, but the dragons had never come. Lenton did not immediately answer, but sat nodding to himself, murmuring,
"Yes, that is right, of course."
He tapped a hand on the desk, looked at some papers without reading them, a portrait of distraction. Lawrence added more sharply,
"Sir, I can hardly believe you would have lent yourself to so treacherous a course, and one so terribly short-sighted. Napoleon's victory was by no means assured if the 20 promised dragons had been sent."
"What?" Lenton looked up.
"Oh, Lawrence, there was no question of that. No, none at all. I am sorry for the secrecy, but as for not sending the dragons, that called for no decision. There were no dragons to send."
Victoriatus heaved his sides out and in, a gentle, measured pace. His nostrils were wide and red. A thick, flaking crust around the rims and a dried pink foam lingered about the corners of his mouth. His eyes were closed, but after every few breaths they would open a little, dull and unseeing with exhaustion. He gave a rasping, hollow cough that flecked the ground before him with blood, and subsided once again into the half-slumber that was all he could manage. His captain, Richard Clarke, was lying on a cot beside him, unshaven, in filthy linen, an arm flung up to cover his eyes, and the other hand resting on the dragon's foreleg. He did not move, even when they approached. After a few moments, Lenton touched Lawrence on the arm.
"Come, enough. Let's away."
He turned slowly aside, leaning heavily upon a cane, and took Lawrence back up the green hill to the castle. The corridors, as they returned to his offices, seemed no longer peaceful, but hushed, sunk in irreparable gloom. Lawrence refused a glass of wine, too numb to think of refreshment.
"It is a sort of consumption,"
Lenton said, looking out the windows that faced onto the covered yard. Victoriatus and 12 other great beasts lay screened from one another by the ancient windbreaks, piled branches and stones grown over with ivy.
"How widespread?" Lawrence asked.
"Everywhere,"
Lenton said.
"Dover, Portsmouth, Middlesbrough. The breeding grounds in Wales and Halifax, Gibraltar. Everywhere the couriers went on their rounds. Everywhere."
He turned away from the windows and took his chair again.
"We were inexpressibly stupid. We thought it was only a cold, you see."
"But we had word of that before we had even rounded the Cape of Good Hope on our journey east,"
Lawrence said, appalled. "Has it lasted so long?"
"In Halifax it started in September of the year 5,
Lenton said.
"The surgeons think now it was the American dragon. That big Indian fellow. He was kept there. And then the first dragons to fall sick here were those who had shared the transport with him to Dover. And then it began in Wales when he was sent to the breeding grounds there. He is perfectly hearty, not a cough or a sneeze. Very nearly the only dragon left in England who is, except for a handful of hatchlings we have tucked away in Ireland."
"You know we have brought you another 20,
Lawrence said, taking a brief refuge in making his report.
"Yes, these fellows from where? Turkestan?"
Lenton said, willing to follow.
"Did I understand your letter correctly? They were brigands?"
"I would rather say jealous of their territory," Lawrence said.
"They are not very pretty, but there is no malice in them. They're what use 20 dragons can be to cover all England."
He stopped.
"Lenton, surely something can be done. Must be done," he said.
Lenton only shook his head briefly.
"The usual remedies did some good at the beginning," he said. "Quieted the coughing and so forth. They could still fly, if they did not have much appetite, and colds are usually such trifling things with them. But it lingered on so long, and after a while the possets seemed to lose their effect. Some began to grow worse."
He stopped, and after a long moment added, with an effort,
"Obsaria is dead."
"Good God!" Lawrence cried.
"Sir, I am shocked to hear it, so deeply grieved."
It was a dreadful loss. She had been flying with Lenton some 40 years, the flag dragon at Dover for the last 10, and though relatively young, had produced 4 eggs already. Perhaps the finest flyer in all England, with few to even compete with her for the title.
"That was in, let me see, August,"
Lenton said, as if he had not heard.
"After In Lacrimas, but before Menacetus. It takes some of them worse than others. The very young hold up best, and the old ones linger. It is the ones between who have been dying. Dying first, anyway. I suppose they will all go in the end."
Chapter 2
"Captain," Keynes said, "I am sorry. Any gormless imbecile can bandage up a bullet wound, and a gormless imbecile you are very likely to be assigned in my place. But I cannot stay with the healthiest dragon in Britain when the quarantine cupboards are full of the sick."
"I perfectly understand, Mr. Keynes, and you need say nothing more," Lawrence said. "Will you not fly with us as far as Dover?"
"No. Victoriatus will not last a week, and I will wait and attend the dissection with Dr. Harrow,"
Keynes said, with a brutal sort of practicality that made Lawrence flinch.
"I have hopes we may learn something of the characteristics of the disease. Some of the couriers are still flying. One will carry me onwards."
"Well," Lawrence said, and shook the surgeon's hand. "I hope we shall see you with us again soon."
"I hope you will not," Keynes said, in his usual acerbic manner. "If you do, I will otherwise be lacking for patients, which from the course of this disease will mean they are all dead."
Lawrence could hardly say his spirits were lowered. They had already been reduced so far as to make little difference out of the loss. But he was sorry. Dragon surgeons were not, by and large, near so incompetent as the naval breed, and despite Keynes's words, Lawrence did not fear his eventual successor. But to lose a good man, his courage and sense proven, and his eccentricities known, was never pleasant. And Temeraire would not like it.
"He is not hurt," Temeraire pressed. He is not sick?
No, Temeraire, but he is needed elsewhere, Lawrence said. He is a senior surgeon. I am sure you would not deny his attentions to those of your comrades who are suffering from this illness.
Well, if Maximus or Lily should need him, Temeraire said crabbily, and drew furrows in the ground. Shall I see them again soon? I am sure they cannot be so very ill. Maximus is the biggest dragon I have ever seen, even though we have been to China. He is sure to recover quickly.
No, my dear, Lawrence said uneasily, and broke the worst of the news. The sick have none of them recovered, and you must take the very greatest care not to go anywhere near the quarantine grounds.
But I do not understand, Temeraire said. If they do not recover, then...
He paused. Lawrence only looked away. Temeraire had good excuse for not understanding at once. Dragons were hardy creatures, and many breeds might live a century and more. He might have justly expected to know Maximus and Lily for longer than a man's lifetime if the war had not taken them from him. At last, sounding almost bewildered, Temeraire said,
"But I have so much to tell them. I came for them, so they might learn that dragons may read and write, and have property, and do things other than fight."
"I will write a letter for you, which we can send to them with your greetings, and they will be happier to know you well and safe from contagion than for your company," Lawrence said.
Temeraire did not answer. He was very still, and his head bowed deeply to his chest.
"We will be nearby," Lawrence went on after a moment, "and you may write to them every day, if you wish, when we have finished our work."
"Patrolling, I suppose," Temeraire said, with a very unusual note of bitterness. "And more stupid formation work, while they are all sick, and we can do nothing."
Lawrence looked down into his lap, where their new orders lay amid the oilcloth packet of all his papers, and had no comfort to offer. Brusque instructions for their immediate removal to Dover, where Temeraire's expectations were likely to be answered in every particular. He was not encouraged, on reporting to the headquarters at Dover directly they had landed, by being left to cool his heels in the hall outside the new admiral's office for 30 minutes, listening to voices by no means indistinct despite the heavy oaken door. He recognized Jane Rowland, shouting. The voices that answered her were unfamiliar, and Lawrence rose to his feet abruptly, straightening as the door was flung open. A tall man in a naval coat came rushing out with clothing and expression both disordered, his lower cheeks mottled to a moderate glow under his sideburns. He did not pause, but threw Lawrence a furious glare before he left.
"Come in, Lawrence, come in!" Jane called,
and he went in. She was standing with the admiral, an older man dressed rather astonishingly in a black frock-coat and knee-breeches with buckled shoes.
"You have not met Dr. Wapping, I think," Jane said. "Sir, this is Captain Lawrence of Temeraire."
"Sir,"
Lawrence said, and made his leg deep to cover his confusion and dismay. He supposed that if all the dragons were in quarantine, to put the covers in the charge of a physician was the sort of thing which might make sense to landsmen, as with a notion advanced to him once by a family friend seeking his influence on behalf of a less fortunate relation, to advance a surgeon, not even a naval surgeon, to the command of a hospital ship.
"Captain, I am honoured to make your acquaintance," Dr. Wapping said. "Admiral, I will take my leave. I beg your pardon for having been the cause of so unpleasant a scene."
"Nonsense! Those rascals at the victualling board are a pack of unhanged scoundrels, and I am happy to put them in their place. Good day to you." "Would you credit, Lawrence," Jane said, as Wapping closed the door behind himself, "that those wretches are not content that the poor creatures eat scarcely enough to feed a bird any more, but they must send us diseased stock and scrawny?" "But this is a way to welcome you home." She caught him by the shoulders and kissed him soundly on both cheeks. "You are a damned sight. Whatever has happened to your coat? Will you have a glass of wine?"
She poured for them both, without waiting his answer. He took it in a sort of appalled blankness.
"I have all your letters, so I have a tolerable notion what you have been doing, and you must forgive me my silence, Lawrence. I found it easier to write nothing than to leave out the only matter of any importance."
"No. That is, yes, of course," he said, and sat down with her at the fire.
Her coat was thrown over the arm of her chair. Now that he looked, He saw the Admiral's fourth bar on the shoulders, and the front more magnificently frogged with braid. Her face, too, was altered, but not for the better. She had lost a stone of weight at least, he thought, and her dark hair, cropped short, was shot with grey.
"Well, I am sorry to be such a ruin," she said ruefully, and laughed away his apologies. "No, we are all of us decaying, Lawrence. There is no denying it. You have seen poor Lenton, I suppose. He held up like a hero for 3 weeks after she died, but then we found him on the floor of his bedroom in an apoplexy. For a week he could not speak without slurring. He came along a good ways afterwards, but still he has been a shade of himself."
"I am sorry for it," Lawrence said, "though I drink to your promotion."
And by Herculean effort he managed it without a stutter.
"I thank you, dear fellow," she said. "I would be et up with pride, I suppose, if matters were otherwise, and if it were not one annoyance after another. We glide along tolerably well when left to our own devices, but I must deal with these idiotish creatures from the Admiralty. They are told before they come, and told again, and still they will simper at me and coo as if I had not been a dragon-back before they were out of dresses, and then they stare if I dress them down for behaving like kiss-my-hand squires."
"I suppose they find it a difficult adjustment," Lawrence said, with private sympathy. "I wonder the Admiralty should have—"
And belatedly he paused, feeling he was treading on obscure and dangerous ground. One could not very well quarrel with pursuing whatever means necessary to reconcile Longwings, perhaps Britain's most deadly breed, to service, and as the beasts would accept none but female handlers, some must be offered them. Lawrence was sorry for the necessity that would thrust a gently-born woman out of her rightful society and into harm's way, but at least they were raised up to it, and where necessary they had perforce to act as formation leaders, transmitting the manoeuvres to their wings. But this was a far cry from flag rank, not to say commanding the largest covert in Britain, and perhaps the most critical.
"They certainly did not like to give it to me, but they had precious little choice," Jane said. "Portland would not come from Gibraltar. Litificat is not up to the sea voyage any more, so it was me or Sanderson, and he is making a cake of himself over the business, goes off into corners and weeps like a woman, as though that would help anything. A veteran of 9 fleet actions, if you would credit it."
Then she ran her hand through her disordered crop and sighed.
"Never mind. You are not to listen to me, Lawrence. I am impatient, and his animosia does poorly."
"And Exidium?" Lawrence ventured.
"Exidium is a tough old bird, and he knows how to husband his strength, has the sense to eat even though he has no appetite. He will muddle along a good while yet, and, you know, he has close on a century of service. Many his age have already shot themselves at the whole business and retired to the breeding grounds."
She smiled. It was not wholehearted.
"There. I have been brave. Let us do pleasanter things. You have brought me 20 dragons, and by God do I have a use for them. Let us go and see them."
"She is a handful and a half,"
Granby admitted lowly, as they considered the coiled, serpentine length of Ischieca's body, faint threads of steam issuing from the many needle-like spikes upon her body.
"And I haven't ridden herd on her, sir. I am sorry."
Ischieca had already established herself to her own satisfaction, if no one else's, by clawing out a deep pit in the clearing next to Temeraire's, where she had been housed, then filling it with ash. This acquired from some 2 dozen young trees, which she had unceremoniously uprooted and burnt up inside her pit. She had then added to the powdery grey mixture a collection of boulders, which she fired to a moderate glow before going to sleep, comfortably, in her heated nest. The bonfire and its lingering smoulder were visible for some distance, even to the farmhouses nearest the covert, and a few hours past her arrival had already produced several complaints and a great deal of alarm.
"Oh, you have done enough keeping her harnessed out in the countryside without a herd of cattle to your name," Jane said, giving the drowsing Ischieca's side a pat. "They may bleat to me all they like for a fire breather, and you may be sure the Navy will cheer your name when they hear we have our own at last. Well done, well done indeed, and I am happy to confirm you in your rank, Captain Granby. Should you like to do the honours, Lawrence?"
Most of Lawrence's crew had already been employed in Ischieca's clearing, in beating out the stray embers which flew out of her pit and threatened to ignite all the covert if left unchecked. Ash, dusty and tired as they all were, they had none of them gone away, lingering consciously without the need of any announcement,
and now lined up on a muttered word from young Lieutenant Ferris to watch Lawrence pin the second pair of gold bars upon Granby's shoulders. "Gentlemen," Jane said, when Lawrence had done, and they gave a cheek-flushed Granby three huzzas, wholehearted if a little subdued, and Ferris and Riggs stepped over to shake him by the hand. "We will see about assigning you a crew, though it is early days yet with her," Jane said after the ceremony had dispersed, and they proceeded on to make her acquainted with the Ferrells. "I have no shortage of men now, more's the pity. Feed her twice daily, see if we cannot make up for any growth she may have been shorted, and whenever she is awake I will start you on long-wing manoeuvres. I don't know if she can scorch herself as they can with their own acid, but we needn't find out by trial."
Granby nodded. He seemed not the least nonplussed at answering to her. Neither did Tharkey, who had been persuaded to stay on at least a little longer, as one of the few of them with any influence upon the Ferrells at all. He rather looked mostly amused in his secretive way, once past the inquiring glance which he had first cast at Lawrence. As Jane had insisted upon being taken to the new-come dragons at once, there had been no chance for Lawrence to give Tharkey a private caution in advance of their meeting. He did not reveal any surprise, however, but only made her a polite bow and performed the introductions quite calmly. Arkady and his band had made very little less confusion of their own clearings than Iskierka, preferring to knock down all the trees between and cluster together in a great heap. The chill of the December air did not trouble them, used as they were to the vastly colder regions of the Pamirs, but they spoke disapprovingly of the dampness, and on understanding that here before them was the senior officer of the covert, at once demanded from her an accounting of the promised cows, one apiece daily, by which they had been lured into service.
"They make the position that if they do not happen to eat the cows upon a given day, still they are owed the cattle, which they may call in at a future time,"
Tharkey explained, provoking Jane's deep laugh.
"Tell them they shall have as much as they like to eat on any occasion, and if they are too suspicious for that to satisfy them, we shall make them a tally. They may each of them take one of these logs they have knocked about over to the feeding-pens and mark it when they take a cow,"
Jane said, more merry than offended at being met with such negotiations.
"Pray ask, will they agree to a rate of exchange? 2 hogs for a cow, or 2 sheep, should we bring in some variety?"
The Ferrells put their heads together and muttered and hissed and whistled amongst themselves in a cacophony made private only by the obscurity of their language, and finally Arkady turned back and professed himself willing to settle on the trade agreement, except that he insisted goats should be 3 to a cow, they having some contempt for that animal, more easily obtained in their former homeland, and likely there to be scrawny. Jane bowed to him to seal the arrangement, and he bobbed his head back, his expression deeply satisfied, and rendered all the more piratical by the red splash of mongrel colour which covered one of his eyes and spilled down his neck.
"They are a gang of ruffians, and make no mistake," Jane said,
as she led them back towards her offices.
"But I have no doubt of their flying, at any rate. With that sort of wiry muscle they will go in circles around anything in their weight class, or over it, and I am happy to stuff their bellies for them."
"No, sir, there'll be no trouble," the steward of the headquarters said, rather low, of finding rooms for Lawrence and his officers, even arriving as they had out of nowhere and without notice. Most of the captains and officers were encamped out in the quarantine grounds with their sick dragons, despite the cold and wet, and the building was queerly deserted, hushed and silent, as it had not been even at the low ebb of the days before Trafalgar, when nearly all the formations had gone south to help bring down the French and Spanish fleets. They all drank Granby's health together, but the party broke up early, and Lawrence was not disposed to linger afterwards. A few wretched lieutenants sitting together at a dark table in the corner, not talking, an older captain snoring with his head tipped against the side of his armchair, a bottle of brandy empty by his elbow. Lawrence took his dinner alone in his rooms near the fire. The air was chill, from the rooms to either side being vacant. He opened the door at a faint tapping, expecting perhaps Jane, or one of his men with some word from Temeraire, and was startled to find instead Tharkey. "Pray come in,"
Lawrence said, and belatedly added,
"I hope you will forgive my state."
The room was yet disordered, and he had borrowed a dressing-gown from a colleague's neglected wardrobe. It was considerably too large around the waist, and badly crumpled.
"I am come to say good-bye,"
Thake said, and shook his head, when Lawrence had made an awkward inquiry.
"No, I have nothing to complain of. But I am not of your company. I do not care to stay only to be a translator. It is a role which must soon pall."
"I would be happy to speak to Admiral Roland. Perhaps a commission," Lawrence said, trailing away.
He did not know what might be done or how such matters were arranged in the corps, except to imagine them a good deal less formally prescribed than in the army or the navy. But he did not wish to promise what might be wholly infeasible.
"I have already spoken to her," Thake said, "and have been given one, if not the sort you mean. I will go back to Turkestan and bring back more ferals, if any can be persuaded into your service on similar terms."
Lawrence would have been a good deal happier to have the ferals already in their service remotely manageable, a quality they were not more likely to gain after Tharkay's departure. But he could not object. It was hard to imagine Tharkay's pride should allow him to remain as a supernumerary, even if restlessness alone did not drive him on.
"I will pray for your safe return," Lawrence said, and offered him instead a glass of port and supper.
"What an odd fellow you have found us, Lawrence," Jane said in her offices the next morning. "I ought to give him his weight in gold, if the Admiralty would not squawk. 20 dragons talked out of the trees, like Merlin. Or was it St. Patrick? Anyway, I'm sorry to rob you of the help, and pray don't think me ungrateful. If you are in your rights to complain, it is enough of a miracle you should have brought us a Skirka and one egg whole, considering the way Bonaparte has been romping about the continent, much less our amiable band of brigands. But I cannot spare the chance of more, however mean and scrawny they might be, not with matters as they stand." The map of Europe was laid out topmost on her table, great clots of markers representing dragons spread from the western borders of Prussia's former territory all the way to the footsteps of Russia. "From Jena to Warsaw in 3 weeks," she said, as one of her runners poured out wine for them. "I would not have given a bad halfpenny for the news if you had not brought it yourself, Lawrence. And if we hadn't had it from the Navy, too, I would have sent you to a physician." Lawrence nodded.
"And I have a great deal to tell you of Bonaparte's aerial tactics, which are wholly changed from what they were. Formations are of no use against him. At Jena, the Prussians were routed, wholly routed. We must at once begin devising counters to his new methods."
But she was already shaking her head. "Do you know, Lawrence, I have less than 40 dragons fit to fly. And unless he is a lunatic, he will not come across with less than 100. He shan't need any fine tactics to do for us. For our part, there is no one to learn any new." The scope of the disaster silenced him. 40 dragons to try and patrol all the coastline of the channel and give cover to the ships of the blockade. "What we want at present is time," Jane continued. "There are a dozen hatchlings in Ireland, preserved from the disease, and twice as many eggs due to hatch in the next 6 months. We bred a good many of them early on. If our friend Bonaparte will only be good enough to give us a year, things will look something more like, with the rest of these new shore batteries in place, the young dragons brought up, your ferals knocked into shape, not to mention Temeraire, and our new fire-breather."
"Will he give us a year?"
Lawrence said, low, looking at the counters. Not very many yet upon the Channel coastline. But he had seen firsthand how swiftly Napoleon's dragon-born army could now move. "Not a minute if he hears anything of our pitiable state," Jane said. "But that aside, well, we hear he has made a very good friend in Warsaw. A Polish countess, they say, is a raving beauty, and he would like to marry the Tsar's sister. We will wish him good fortune in his courting, and hope he takes a long, leisurely time about it. If he is sensible, he will want a winter night for crossing the channel, and the days are already growing longer. But you may be sure that if he learns how thin we are on the ground, he will come posting back quick as lightning and damn the ladies. So our task of the moment is to keep him properly in the dark. A year's time, then we will have something to work with. But until then, for you all, it must be—"
"Oh, patrolling,"
Temeraire said in tones of despair when Lawrence had brought their orders.
"I am sorry, my dear," Lawrence said, "very truly sorry. But if we can serve our friends at all, it will be by taking on those duties which they have had to set aside."
Temeraire was silent and brooding unconsoled. In an attempt to cheer him, Lawrence added, "But we need not abandon your cause, not in the least. I will write my mother and those of my acquaintance who may have the best advice to give on how we ought to proceed."
"Whatever sense is there in it," Temeraire said, miserably, "when all our friends are ill, and there is nothing to be done for them? It does not matter if one is not allowed to visit London, if one cannot even fly an hour. And Arcady does not give a fig for liberty anyway. All he wants are cows. We may as well patrol, or even do formations."
This was the mood in which they went aloft, a dozen of the Ferrels behind them more occupied in squabbling amongst themselves than in paying any attention to the sky. Temeraire was in no way inclined to make them mind, and with Tharkay gone, the few hapless officers set upon their backs had very little hope of exerting any form of control. These young men had been chosen, from no shortage of officers, so many men having been grounded by the illness of their assigned beasts, for their skill in language. The Ferrels were all of them far too old to acquire a new tongue easily, so the officers should have to learn theirs instead. To hear them trying to whistle and cluck out the awkward syllables of the Durzag language had quickly palled as entertainment and grown a nuisance to the ear, but it had also to be endured. No one knew the tongue with any fluency aside from Temeraire, and a few of Lawrence's younger officers who had acquired a smattering in the course of their journey to Istanbul. Lawrence had indeed lost two of his already diminished number of officers entirely to the cause. One of the riflemen, Dunn, and Wickley of the bellmen had both of them enough grasp of Durzag to make the basic signals understood to the Ferrels, and they were not so young as to make a command absurd. They had been set aboard Arcady in a highly theoretical position of authority. There was none of that natural bond which the first harnessing seemed to produce, of course, and Arcady was far more likely to obey his own whimsical impulse than any orders which they might give. The Ferrel leader had already given it as his opinion that this flying over the ocean was absurd, as a useless territory in which no reasonable dragon would interest itself, and the likelihood he would veer away at any moment in search of better entertainment seemed to Lawrence high. Jane had set them a course along the coastline for their first excursion. No risk at all of an action so near to land, but at least the cliffs interested the Ferrels, and the bustle of shipping around Portsmouth, which they would gladly have investigated further if not called to order by Temeraire. They flew on past Southampton and westward along towards Weymouth, setting a leisurely pace, the Ferrels resorting to wild acrobatics to entertain themselves, swooping to such heights as must have rendered them dizzy and ill save for their former habituation among the most lofty mountains of the earth, and plummeting thence into absurd and dangerous diving manoeuvres, so close they threw up spray as they skimmed up again from the waves. It was a sad waste of energy, but well-fed as the Ferrels now were, by comparison to their previous state, of energy they had a surfeit which Lawrence was glad enough to see spent in so restrained a manner, if the officers clinging sickly to their harnesses did not agree.
"Perhaps we might try a little fishing," Temeraire suggested, turning his head around, when abruptly Gernet cried out above them, and the world spun and whirled as Temeraire flung himself sidelong. A pêcheur went flying past, and the champagne popping of rifle fire spat at them from his back.
"To stations!"
Ferris was shouting, men scrambling wildly. The bellmen were casting off a handful of bombs down on the recovering French dragon below, while Temeraire veered away, climbing. Arcady and the Ferrels were shrilly calling to one another, wheeling excitedly. They flung themselves with eagerness on the French dragons, a light scouting party of six, as best Lawrence could make out, among the low-flying clouds. The pêcheur the largest of the lot, and the rest all lightweights or couriers. Both outnumbered and outweighed, therefore, and reckless to be coming so close to British shores. Reckless or deliberately venturesome, Lawrence thought grimly it could not have escaped the notice of the French that their last encounter had brought no answer from the coverts.
"Lawrence, I am going after that pêcheur. Arcady and the others will take the rest,"
Temeraire said, curving his head around even as he dived. The Ferrels were not shy by any means, and gifted skirmishers from all their play. Lawrence thought it safe to leave the smaller dragons entirely to them.
"Pray make no sustained attack," he called through the speaking trumpet. "Only roust them from the shore, as quickly as you may—"
as the hollow thump-thump of bombs exploding below interrupted. Without the hope of surprise, the pêcheur knew himself thoroughly overmatched, Temeraire a more agile flyer, and in a wholly different class so far as weight. Having risked and lost a throw of the dice, he and his captain were evidently not inclined to try their luck again. Temeraire had scarcely stooped before the pêcheur dropped low to the water and beat away quickly over the waves, his riflemen keeping up a steady fusillade to clear his retreat. Lawrence turned his attention above to the furious howling of the ferals' voices. They could scarcely be seen, having lured the French high aloft, where their greater ease with the thin air could tell to their advantage.
"Where the devil is my glass?"
he said, and took it from Allen. The ferals were making a sort of taunting game of the business, darting in at the French dragons and away, setting up a raucous caterwauling as they went, without very much actual fighting to be seen. It would have done nicely to frighten away a rival gang in the wild, Lawrence supposed, particularly one so outnumbered, but he did not think the French were to be so easily diverted. Indeed, as he watched, the five enemy dragons, all of them only little poux de ciels, drew into close formation and promptly bowled through the cloud of ferals. The ferals, still putting on a show of bravado, scattered too late to evade the rifle fire, and now some of their shrill cries were for real pain. Temeraire was beating up furiously, his sides belling out like sails as he heaved for the breath to get himself so high aloft. But he could not easily gain their height, and would be at a disadvantage himself against the smaller French when he had.
"Give them a gun, quickly, and show the signal for descent!" Lawrence shouted to Turner, without much hope.
But the ferals came plummeting down in a rush when Turner put out the flags, none too reluctant to put themselves around Temeraire. Arcady was keeping up a low, indignant clamouring under his breath, nudging anxiously at his second, Ringe, the worst hit, her dark grey hide marred with streaks of darker blood. She had taken several balls to the flesh and one unlucky hit to the right wing, which had struck her on the bias and scraped a long, ugly furrow across the tender webbing and two spines. She was listing in mid-air awkwardly as she tried to favour it.
"Send her below to shore!"
Lawrence said, scarcely needing the speaking trumpet, with the dragons crowded so close that they might have been talking in a clearing and not the open sky.
"And pray tell them again they must keep well clear of the guns. I'm sorry they've had so hot a lesson. Let us keep together, and—"
But this came too late, as the French were coming down in arrowhead formation, and the ferals followed too closely on his first instruction and spread themselves out across the sky. The French also at once separated. Even together they were not a match for Temeraire, whom they had surely recognised, and by way of protection engaged themselves closely with the ferals. It must have been an odd experience for them. Poux de ciels were generally the lightest of the French combat breeds, and now they were finding themselves the relative heavyweights in battle against the ferals, who, even where their wingspan and length matched, were all of them lean and concave-bellied creatures, a sharp contrast against the deep-chested muscle of their opponents. The ferals were now more wary, but also more savage, hot with anger at the injury to their fellow and their own smaller, stinging wounds. They used their darting lunges to better effect, learning quickly how to feint in and provoke the rifle volleys, then come in again for a real attack. The smallest of them, Guerny and motley-coloured Lester, were attacking one poux de ciel together, with the more wily Hertas pouncing in every now and again, claws blackened with blood. The others were engaged singly and more than holding their own. But Lawrence quickly perceived the danger, even as Temeraire called,
"Arcady! Neige! Slitacom!"
and broke off to say,
"Lawrence, they are not listening."
"Yes, they will be in the soup in a moment," Lawrence agreed.
The French dragons, though they seemed on the face of it to be fighting as independently as the ferals, were manoeuvring skilfully to put their backs to one another. Indeed, they were only allowing the ferals to herd them into formation, which should allow them to make another devastating pass.
"Can you break them apart when they have come together?"
"I do not see how I will be able to do it without hurting our friends. They are so close to one another, and some of them are so little,"
Temeraire said anxiously, tail lashing as he hovered.
"Sir," Ferris said, and Lawrence looked at him. "I beg your pardon, sir, but we are always told, as a rule, to take a bruising before a ball. It don't hurt them long, even if they are knocked properly silly, and we are close enough to give any of them a lift to land if it should go so badly."
"Very good. Thank you, Mr. Ferris,"
Lawrence said, putting strong approval in it. He was still very glad to see Granby matched off with his Kierke, even more so when dragons would now be in such short supply, but he felt the loss keenly as exposing the weaknesses in his own abbreviated training as an aviator. Ferris had risen to his occasions with near heroism, but he had been but a third lieutenant on their departure from England scarcely a year ago, and at 19 years of age could not be expected to put himself forward to his captain with the assurance of an experienced officer. Temeraire put his head down and puffed up his chest with a deep breath, then flung himself down amongst the shrinking knot of dragons, and barreled through with much the effect of a cat descending upon an unsuspecting flock of pigeons. Friend and foe alike went tumbling wildly. The ferals flung into higher excitement. They flew around with much disorderly shrilling for a few moments, and as they did, the French righted themselves. The formation leader waved a signal flag, and the Poudriciers wheeled together and away, escaping.